to Midrashet Yom Rishon. My name is Rebecca Moses, and I work in the Department of Community Initiatives in Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future. If you could, please remember to fill out our questionnaires in the back. Your feedback helps us maintain top-quality programming that meets everyone's needs and interests. Also, as always, recordings of the Shirim will be available shortly on the Marcos and Adina Katz YUTorah.org website. Also, if you could please turn off your cell phones and please refrain from asking questions in the middle of the shiur. There will be a question time after the shiur. Today's learning in both Kohel and Midrashet Yom Rishon is dedicated in memory of Abraham Arbisfeld, whose yahrzeit is being observed today. Our speakers will elaborate upon the life and legacy of Abraham Arbisfeld. We are honored today to hear our first shiur from Rabbi Kenneth Brander, who will speak on the topic of stem cell research in Jewish law. Rabbi Brander is the dean of Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future, which was launched in 2004. The CJF is the nexus of Yeshiva University's efforts to shape and effectively impact Jewish life and the Jewish future. Prior to assuming this position, Rabbi Brander served 14 years as the rabbi of the Boker Raton Synagogue, where he was instrumental in building up the community at large. Rabbi Brander is an alumnus of Yeshiva College and received his ordination at Reitz. He received special ordination from Machon Pua, which is the Center of Medical Ethics in Israel, in 1999, and from Chief Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu in the field of medical ethics, infertility, gynecology, and halacha. Rabbi Brander is currently a PhD candidate in general philosophy at Florida Atlantic University. It is now my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Brander.
Thank you, Rebecca. Good morning, everyone. The topic of today's lecture is stem cell research. It's entitled Society's Heart Cell, Stem Cell Research Condemned, Condoned, or Encouraged by Jewish Law. Before I begin, I want to, just for a moment, mention again that the learning that we're going to do today is in loving memory of Abraham Arbisfeld. While I did not have the opportunity to know Abraham Arbisfeld, I do have the opportunity to know his grandchildren, to know the children of Hai and Ann Arbisfeld. And perhaps in the past generation, we defined Yichus by the previous generation, but in this generation, I believe, we define our Yichus by our children and by our grandchildren. I've had the opportunity to interact with Abraham Arbisfeld's grandchildren in the shir of Rav Schechter on the west side of Manhattan in various different leadership opportunities, and consistently they truly celebrate the ideals of Torah, of creating a legacy of Torah. And so I am confident that Abraham Arbisfeld's memory is blessed not only through the learning that we do today, but through the life of his children and of his grandchildren. This issue of stem cell research requires a slight overview of what exactly stem cell research is before we evaluate some of the halachot of stem cell research. So let us, for a few moments, just do a cursory overview of exactly what stem cell research is. So if we could turn to our handouts and look at figure one. Figure number one represents a standard in vitro fertilization process in which, instead of conception happening within the fallopian tube of a woman, the conception is happening within a laboratory, where the sperm and egg are brought together within the laboratory and the egg is fertilized. Immediately after fertilization, within the first few days, there is what is called the development of the fertilized egg into totipotent cells. Totipotent cells are the following. They are cells that are totally potent. They are cells that have the capacity to really develop any organ of the human body, whether it's the organ of the liver, the heart, the nervous system, etc., etc., etc. Eventually, cells begin to specialize, at this stage, they have the capacity to really become any one of the organs of the human body. Within 3 to 5 days, it moves to the stage called blastocyst, in which cells begin to specialize. The outer rim of those cells serve as the placenta, the umbilical cord, and others, things necessary to guarantee the nutrition of the fetus. The inner cell mass is now what is called pluripotent. Pluripotent means they're not totally potent anymore, but they have the capacity in many different ways still to become many different organs. They can't become the placenta anymore, but they have the capacity to become, again, many different organs of the human body. So if you look at figure 2, that really just amplifies what I just said. You have totipotent cells immediately after fertilization. They become pluripotent cells, and then they become more committed. They become blood stem cells. They become cells that develop the heart, cells that develop the pancreas, etc., etc., etc. Now, stem cell research represents the following idea. Let us assume, which is 100% possible in this day and age, that one takes a fertilized egg at its blastocyst stage, at the stage in which it's only 3 to 5 days old. At that stage, the fertilized egg can be frozen. It can be frozen for 5 months, 5 years, or 500 years. And then it can be thawed again, and then totally functional, beginning the fifth day, as if it didn't skip a beat. It can be frozen for 500 years, and then unfrozen, and then continue on within this process. Let's assume that one does the following. Let's look at figure number 3. So far, is everyone with me? Okay? Look at figure number 3. Let's say we take the following. We'll use me as an example. We take a cell from my hand, and we take that cell, and we remove the genetic matter within an egg of a woman, and we put the cell from my hand into that egg. So now you have an egg that doesn't have half the genetic matter necessary to create a human being, but the complete genetic matter to create a human being. And that genetic matter matches mine 100% because it came from me. And let's say I do the following. I take that egg that I tricked, and I put my cellular matter in it, and I trick it again, and I fertilize it by giving it some type of electrical shock. And it goes through the same process of development as if it was just fertilized. So look at figure number 3. It's called somatic cell nuclear transfer. I take out the genetic matter within the egg. I put in my genetic matter. And all of a sudden, 5 days into it, I have pluripotent cells that exactly match my genetic matter, my genetic identity. Now, let's say, God forbid, I suffer from some type of disease, diabetes. And instead of dealing with the disease by giving me medicine, I want to deal with the disease on a much better level, on a cellular level, by injecting into my body new cells that could reshape my pancreas, so now that my pancreas can produce the appropriate insulin. Well, I take these totipotent cells and I turn on the volume of the cellular encyclopedia, volume P for pancreas. I inject those cells within my body, and instead of dealing with the diabetes on a level in which I have to inject insulin or take some type of medicine like glucophage or something of that nature, I now deal with the problem on a much, much better level. I repair the cellular structure. Or if somebody has a cardiac challenge, so you have to take all types of medicines, a lot of invasive surgery, but perhaps what I can do is I can take a cell at the totipotent stage or the pluripotent stage, inject it into my body, and all of a sudden changed the cardiac development of my heart by putting into it new cardiac cells that can replace those that have been damaged. In other words, through stem cell research, let's turn to the next page of the handout. Through stem cell research, figure number four, instead of developing medicines that can solve problems like Alzheimer's, like dealing with issues of a person being paralyzed, or other issues regarding, like for example, diabetes, I can deal with it on a cellular level. I can take a fertilized egg that is at the stage of blastocyst, that's pluripotent, and I can develop perhaps those cells to focus on a particular organ that is damaged. Is it permitted for me to do such a thing? Now here are the challenges. Stem cell research, in order for it to move to its next stage, that it can truly achieve the promises of stem cell research, to deal with diseases on a cellular level, will require me manipulating fertilized eggs that are no longer needed by a spouse, by a couple. A couple is having challenges having a family. The woman harvests 20, 30 eggs. She uses a few of them to have children. But now, after Baruch Hashem, she has a family, she has a few fertilized eggs that she no longer needs. Can science take those fertilized eggs, which again, if you look at figure number one, would be at the blastocyst stage. They're frozen. They're in the blastocyst stage. If I put them in a womb, they will develop into a human being. But in this area, at this point in time, they will not develop into anything. Can I take them out of the freezer, manipulate them, so science can advance to the point in which it can tell cells how to develop so you can deal with challenges like Alzheimer's, like diabetes, like paralysis, and a host of other challenges that we are struggling to deal with in society? Is it halakhically permitted for me to manipulate a fertilized egg at the stage of blastocyst, 3 to 5 days of development, in order to create the next generation of medicines that deal with repairing organic structures on the cellular level? That's the question in front of us. Does everyone understand the science? Does anyone, despite the request of not to ask any questions till the end, we'll take a pause for a moment here. Does everyone understand the issue of the science here? The capacity of the science? If you don't, raise your hand, because...
How was that egg fertilized?
That egg was fertilized by a husband's sperm.
Regular fertilization.
Eventually, what could happen is that you can do what I said in figure number three, and that is do what's called somatic cell nuclear transfer, in which you can take the cellular matter from an individual, put it within the fertilized egg, and then fertilize the egg, not with sperm, because that would add too much genetic matter within the egg, but just trick the egg by just fertilizing it with electric stun. But now we're at the point where we have all of these extra fertilized eggs in freezers and laboratories around the country. Is it permitted to use those fertilized eggs to be involved in stem cell research, which can again create drugs that could solve hundreds of problems on a cellular level? Any other questions on this? Yes. What? Very good question. If the organ became dysfunctional with those cells, so why would you want to put those cells in again? So let's say a person gets diabetes at the age of 50, okay? 60. And the cells became dysfunctional at 60. Well, you'll put those cells in again, and then when the person's 120 years old, you'll have to put them in a third time. We should all have those challenges. The same thing was true with cardiac issues and other things of that nature. A lot of these issues, Alzheimer's, they don't happen when a person's 10 years old. They happen when a person is towards mid or later in life, and therefore the cellular repairs could have, and sometimes it's because of trauma or stress or inappropriate environmental issues that cause the cellular damage, and you could obviate those external factors to achieve, so that the next time you inject it, it can be done more effectively. Yes?
So this would not apply to diseases that are genetic or that are there in childhood?
There are other forms, this is not the class for today, called PGD, pre-implementation genetic diagnosis, that can deal with those issues. Most of the students in the SMICHA program are actually going through a class to learn all the halakhic issues dealing with the thing that you just articulated. And if you go on yutorah.org, you'll find that there are several classes on your question. That's correct. But that's a different form of scientific development that's happening right now in every reproductive laboratory in the country. Yes? Now, the stem cell research, I am talking about the examples I've given you is the full bandwidth of stem cell research. And the stem cell research that's most controversial is the one that I just mentioned, and that is when you have fertilized eggs that have the potential, if put back into the womb, to become human beings, that at the blastocyst stage of development, which again is 3 to 5 days, would be manipulated in ways to achieve the goals that I just articulated. That's the one that's most controversial. Why don't we go on a little bit further? Let's look at one other figure here that really summarizes everything that I just said. And that is stem cell therapy using cell nuclear replacement. I skipped the cloning issues. But basically, what you just see here is the development. You remove the patient cell. You remove the matter from the egg of the genetic matter from the egg. You fuse the cellular matter from the man or woman into the empty eggshell. You stimulate its development, and eventually you'll get to the point of pluripotent cells, cells that can be used for most organs, and then you manipulate those cells so they become either cardiac cells, pancreatic cells, blood cells, depending on the challenge of the particular person. That's the science. What does halakha have to say about that? That's the exploration that we'll take for the next 35 minutes together. So if you look, there's a midrash that I've placed here for your review. And this midrash reminds us of a very important halakhic concept. And that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not create a perfect world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created an imperfect world, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is looking for partners. And those partners are all of us. The Takein Olam B'Malchut Shakai. We're here to finish the completion and the creation of the world that God created. We're here to be God's partners. We are in search of a relationship with God, and God is in search of a relationship with us. We celebrate our relationship with God by finishing the creative process that God began. We are involved in what's called imitatio Dei, imitating God. We're involved in tikkun olam. That is our responsibility within this world. And God imposed upon himself the notion of tzimtzum, of withdrawal, in order to empower us to play that partnership with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what the Midrash is reminding us. And then, source number B is a famous Gemara that discusses a dialogue between the Roman governor of Judea, Turnus Rufus, and the major rabbinic personality during the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 CE, and that is Rabbi Akiva. Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva are having a dialogue. They say like this. Turnus Rufus turns to Rabbi Akiva and says, "If your God loves the poor, why does he not support them?" And Rabbi Akiva responds, "Because we support the poor, and that allows us a path to the world to come and removes us from entering Gehenna." Turnus Rufus says just the opposite. Anybody that helps a poor person is condemned to hell. And he explains it in the following way. Suppose a king incarcerated one of his subjects and said to everybody that no one is to give that subject any food or any drink. And somebody clandestinely gave that subject who was incarcerated food or drink. Would not the king be upset about the fact that somebody defied his orders? And we are called, the Jewish people are called servants of God. What right do we have, says Ternus Rufus, to defy God in helping the poor? And Rabbi Akiva says the following. Suppose that the king incarcerated one of his children and told everybody not to give his child food or drink. And somebody gave that child food or drink anyways. Would not the king be happy that someone saved his child? And we are called the children of God. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. And therefore, it is our responsibility to help the poor. The argument between Ternus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva in this Talmudic passage is about whether we take a providential view on what's going on in the world. Ternus Rufus says, we wear the glasses of God. If somebody is going through cardiac distress, what right do I have to be involved in helping that person through scientific research? If somebody is challenged with diabetes, what right do I have to go through scientific research to help heal that individual? Because if God willed it, and we are the servants of God, like that king, we must follow God's wishes. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, that is not the Jewish way. We are the children of God, and we are here to help our fellow siblings, the world community. That's what God wants from us. We don't ask ourselves, when people go through challenging times, why this happened. Our question is, when something like this happens, how can we affect change for that individual? That is the fundamental approach, gestalt, of the Jewish people when it comes to helping those in need. This all points to our responsibility to be involved in helping those individuals going through challenging situations and recognizing that science is the gift that God has given us to empower us to make those changes. So let's explore where halakha is so concerned about life, where the halakha allows us to be involved in stem cell research. If we turn to page 5 of our handout, we'll begin to explore some of the makorot. Let me begin by answering the question in a very emphatic way, that halakha gives us 100% permission to be involved with stem cell research. Halakha encourages us to be involved with stem cell research, and I'd like to explain where this position can be found within Jewish law. First of all, how do we treat a fetus that is less than 40 days old and that is not yet within the womb? Well, first of all, we don't call it yet, in halachic terms, we don't call it yet a fetus. In fact, the Gemara tells us, in source number 1 on page 5, in Yevamos, Daf Tzadiket Amadet, that ad arba'im, until the 40th day, maya ba'almahi, the fetus is just considered a sack of water, fluid. In fact, if one looks at fetal development and looks at the various pictures, you'll notice that fetal development really begins in earnest around the 40th day. You begin to see the beginnings of shapings of a fetus. Halakha clearly articulates throughout the Talmud and throughout halakha that pre-40 days, fetal matter is considered just a sack of water. That has many halakhic ramifications. Let me just articulate one of them. We know that if a woman gives birth to a baby boy, and is not either she or her husband are not from the Kohen or Levi tribes, or descendants of Kohen or Levi, the halacha is that the child goes through Pidyon Haben. If a woman has a miscarriage the first time she gives birth, the first time she's pregnant, the next child that is born does not go through the process of a pidyon haben, because it needs to be the first fruit of her womb, and if she had a miscarriage, she does not have a pidyon haben for the next child. What happens if the miscarriage happened when the fetus was less than 40 days old? The halakha is clear that the next child born goes through a pidyon haben, because the fetus is not yet considered a halakhic fetus. It is just a sack of water. It does not yet have the status of a fetus, of the fruit of her womb. And therefore, the next child that is born still has a halakhic responsibility, the family, the parents, to go through the process of pidyon haben. This idea is highlighted in other halachot. Can I acquire something for the fetus that my wife is carrying? The answer is, I can make a kinyan on behalf of the fetus that my wife is carrying, provided that the fetus is more than 40 days old. Again, showing that the halakhic divide in when we term a baby a fetus in utero is only post 40 days. This highlights to us the idea that Judaism does not give any definition of any form of halakhic validity to a fetus pre-40 days old. And therefore, the cellular matter in that embryo that we discussed in the laboratory, the egg that has been fertilized, can be manipulated in the blastocyst stage of development, because that stage is less than 40 days. So halakha would have no challenge whatsoever with manipulating the fetal matter that would be found in the laboratory, simply because at that point in time, halakha does not yet give it any status at all of a fetus or having any status of a life. In general, a fetus in utero, halakha is challenged whether it is considered a full life. At different stages of fetal development, halakha gives the fetus different levels of life. But what is clear is, halakha is challenged regarding the issue of abortion. What is the prohibition of abortion? Yes, we forbid abortion in most cases. There are times in which we permit abortion. If a woman's life is in danger, we permit abortion. In fact, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rebbe Eliezer Waldenberg, went so far as to say that if a woman is carrying a Tay-Sachs baby and knows that it is a Tay-Sachs baby and knows that a Tay-Sachs child will live a very difficult life and challenging life, and the family feels that it cannot psychologically handle it, Rav Waldenberg considered that a threat to the woman's life and permits an abortion up to the 7th month when you know you're carrying a fetus that has Tay-Sachs. The whole idea regarding the notion of abortion, while I must stress that halakha does not permit it, but halakha is challenged by finding what is the isser. So you have, like in source 6, the isser is an isser of chavala, of doing a wound for no reason. Or the chavos ya'ir, that discusses that it's a form of moti shivcha zera levatala, that the sperm used to fertilize the egg is now being wasted. The idea is that the Rishonim and Achronim search for what the isser is of abortion. And yes, as the fetus develops, as the Rambam articulates, it can be considered a form of homicide, but it is clear that halakha does not consider abortion an act of murder in any way, because the fetus, until it is born, is not yet considered a life. So much so that halakha does not consider a fetus, especially when it's less than 40 days old, a life, that the following question is asked by the Rishonim. We know that once a fetus is 40 days old, halakha tells us that you can violate Shabbos to save the fetus. Because it is considered a quasi-life, we frown upon any form of abortion at that point, and therefore, if there is a challenge to the fetus, you violate the Shabbos to save the fetus. What happens if the fetus is less than 40 days old? We consider it a sack of water. how is it permitted to violate the Shabbos for a sack of water? If the woman's life is not challenged whatsoever, just the fetus, and we know the fetus is less than 40 days old, is it permitted to drive to the hospital to save this fetus that is less than 40 days old? The Ramban and Bahag come to the conclusion that the only reason why it is permitted to violate the Shabbat to save a fetus that is less than 40 days old is because, as it says in source number 9, that on page 5, that it is permitted to violate one Shabbat in order that eventually, as this fetus develops into a human being, it will be able to celebrate many Shabbatot. The license to violate the Shabbat is not because it is yet considered a living being, because it's less than 40 days old. The license is predicated on the fact that by violating this Shabbat, you will empower eventually this fetus that will eventually become a human being to, please God, celebrate many Shabbatot. This once again accentuates the idea that fetal material less than 40 days old is not considered halakhically any status of a human being. And therefore, to manipulate that material to save others should be 100% permitted. Yes, you have to be. In fact, the following question is posed based on this Shita of the Rishonim. And allow me to set it in the place in which it was asked. Due to the abundance of hurricanes in South Florida, and sometimes there are actually power outages at the same time, there was a lab which had many fertilized eggs in it that lost power. And let's assume for 1 second that the lab did not have a backup generator, which all labs do. And the embryologist, who is Shomer Shabbat, gets beeped that his lab has lost power. And you have all these fertilized eggs in a freezer at the blastocyst stage of development. Again, they're less than 40 days old. And they're thawing out. And they basically will be destroyed. Can he drive to his lab to save those fertilized eggs within the freezer? The answer is no. Because it's less than 40 days old, and the only reason why the Ramban and the Bahag permit the violation of Shabbat is because this fetal material, less than 40 days old, is in the womb, and therefore it is in a location in which it will eventually become a human being. So because there is the capacity for that fetal material to eventually become a human being, so then we're allowed to violate the Shabbat in order to save that fetal material. But the fetal material in the freezer can be there for 1,000 years, and it will never be anything more than fetal material that's 4 to 5 days old. And therefore, there is no permission to violate the Shabbat. This idea is highlighted in the next page of our handout, in source number 6, in the Nishmas Ha'adam. And in source number 12, where Rav Mordechai Eliyahu permits one to destroy fertilized eggs, especially those that may have genetic challenges to them, because of the fact that they are not yet considered in any way, shape, or form having any status of a human being. This is also why the great Posek who recently passed away, Rev Zilberstein, also permits one to destroy fetal material, especially those that have genetic challenges to them, because again, there is not yet the halachic status of any form of human being to that fetal material. If I haven't stressed it enough, I'm trying to just to show you through a plethora of sources that halacha does not consider a egg at the stage in which stem cell research would be involved in manipulating the material to be considered in any way, shape, or form a human being. And therefore, this material, as Rav Aaron Soloveitchik calls it, that it should be considered as Totseret Japan, as if it's made in Japan, and that's the way you should look at this material. It is accentuating the idea that it is 100% permitted for us, and not just permitted. It is a halachic requirement for us to be able to use this genetic material in order to be able to achieve the next generation of medicines to help and repair society. In fact, Rabbi Temler, on page 7, in his usual quiet way, highlights this idea also in source 14. The Judeo-biblical tradition does not grant moral status to an embryo before 40 days of gestation. Such an embryo has the same moral status as male and female gametes, and its destruction prior to implantation is of the same moral import as the wasting of human seed. In our case, the issue of wasting human seed would not apply, because all of these fertilized eggs were created initially to be placed back in utero in order to have children. But when you go through an IVF process, you don't just take 3 eggs and fertilize 3 eggs. You fertilize a whole bunch. In case the fertilization process doesn't take, you have additional fertilized eggs to work from. Therefore, the wasting of the seed issue, Hotzah Shiv Chazer Levatala, would not apply because the seed here was used in a procreative way. These are just the residual eggs that were not used after the couple was able to have the children that they wished. He is very strong about the notion of what we consider a fetus once it is within the uterus, within the woman. I think his statement is not consistent with everybody's halakhic position, but for our focus, we're focusing on genetic material that is less than 40 days old, that is not within the womb. And Rabbi Tendler summarizes quite nicely all of the Rishonim and Achronim that we just studied together. But perhaps what I'd wish to show you in the remaining time we have together is an unbelievable idea that unfortunately we take for granted the importance of the Masorah, of recognizing that we can only study the biblical text through the eyes of Chazal, through the eyes of the Talmud. And allow me to explain to you how 2 psukim that are found in Parshat Mishpatim really represent the divide that is now found in the U.S. House of Representatives and in the White House based on this issue of stem cell research. 2 psukim in the Chumash are really the springboard for what the entire world is discussing on the issue of stem cell research. And without looking at those 2 psukim through the eyes of Chazal, perhaps we would not be able to embrace stem cell research in the way I have articulated. These 2 psukim are found in Parshat Mishpatim. We know that the halakha tells us that if somebody damages another person, damages a limb of another person, that the halakha is clear that you have to pay some type of monetary compensation. Ayin tachat ayin isn't defined literally, it's defined through compensation. And if, God forbid, somebody kills somebody, while the Talmud tells us that if a Beit Din, if a Jewish court, would ever kill somebody, that once in 70 years it was considered an aggressive court, but capital punishment is on the table. If I kill another human being, there is the potential that I myself will be killed. So let's study 2 psukim together that I think we're all familiar with. V'chi inatsu anashim. I'm sorry, all you have is the Christian translation to the psukim in front of you, and I would ask you not to look at the Christian translation yet, but for us to first develop it based on our translation. V'chi yinatsu anashim v'nakfu isha hara. If 2 men were fighting, v'nakfu isha hara, and they hit accidentally, in the process of the 2 of them fighting, they hit a woman who's pregnant. V'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yiyah ason. Can someone please translate those words for me? V'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yiyeh ason. There are no grades here. We're not going to change your college transcripts. V'yatsu yiladeha. The children were born. V'lo yiyeh ason. And there was no damage to who? To the children. Anyone else want to give another interpretation to those words? I'm sorry? Well, I'm asking you for your interpretation of that catastrophe. Mrs. Kranzler has articulated her interpretation. Good. Yes? So you have two ways that you can translate these words. V'yatsu yiladeha can either be translated through door number one, which means that the children were born prematurely. V'lo yason, nothing happened to the children. So the children were born prematurely. That was the explanation given initially in this room. And what happened was, v'lo yason, there was no damage that happened to the children other than the fact that they were born prematurely, child or children, and therefore only monetary compensation needs to be given to help with perhaps the additional medical costs due to the premature labor. And then the pasuk continues, the next pasuk, v'im ason yiyeh, and if there was a tragedy, which according to the first way it was translated means there was a miscarriage, then nefesh tachas nefesh, there could be capital punishment. The first way that was just that these psukim were translated is not the way they are translated within the Gemara. Even though it makes logical sense to translate it that way, it's not our Mesorah of how to translate the psukim. The second way that it was articulated is the way our Mesorah is to translate these psukim. Two men are fighting. V'nakfu isha hara, and a woman who's pregnant was hit, v'yatsu yiladeha, and she miscarried, v'lo yiyeh ason. But she is fine. She is still alive. So what happens? You have to pay money. Why? Because Judaism does not yet consider the fetus a human being. And therefore, there is no capital punishment. V'im ason yiyeh. But if there was damage to the woman, she was killed. Then, nefesh tachas nefesh. Then those two individuals who were involved in this, they can be killed because they destroyed this human being, this woman. How do you translate these psukim? If you translate these psukim the way our rabbis translated these psukim, the way the Mesorah celebrates the translation of these psukim, then what it represents and what it celebrates is clear. That the fetus is not yet considered a human being. And therefore it is like a limb of the mother. And therefore the only thing on the table for damages is financial compensation. If you define the fetus the way the Christians do, then they read these verses differently. V'yatsu yiladeha. The children were born. V'lo yiyeh ason. Nothing happened to the fetuses. And therefore, there's only money. V'im yiyeh ason. But if something happens to the fetuses, they're considered like human beings already. From the moment of fertilization, they're considered human beings. And therefore, nefesh tachas nefesh. Kill fetuses, you can be put to death. This challenge and how to understand these two psukim in Mishpatim is the challenge that you will find in the White House and in the United States House of Representatives on the issue of how to deal with stem cell research. The Christian right has decided, based on a mistranslation of those psukim found in Latin and Greek and eventually translated into English that way, as found in four different translations that I am submitting to you for your perusal on page 7, have translated the verses in a way in which the ason that can cause capital punishment is the loss of fetal life. In halakha, the tragedy that can cause capital punishment is not the loss of fetal life, but the loss of human life, the loss of life of the mother. That is the divide between the Christian rite and the Jewish perspective. That misunderstanding of two psukim in Tanakh is the point of departure and how we look at stem cell research. If anyone ever asks, how important is it to understand Tanakh? How important is it to understand Parshat Mishpatim? After all, it is dealing with oxes goring other oxes. It's dealing with people falling down into pits, which are potholes. It's dealing with all these other challenges. What relevance does Parshat Mishpatim have to my life? The entire American legal system, the entire system is being held up and going through religious gymnastics based on their understanding of two psukim in Parsha Shemos, in Sefer Shemos, in Parsha Mishpatim. And it is only when we view these psukim through the eyes of Chazal, which then becomes the development in which we define that the first 40 days are considered Maya Ba'alma, and we understand the science, the Mada and the Torah, and we can put those two together, do we have a clear understanding of our halachic responsibility to not only be parav on the issue of stem cell research, but to embrace it, to celebrate it, to recognize that with every scientific discovery, there needs to be an ethical filter to, in order to make sure that, God forbid, we don't start finding women who need money and asking them to harvest their eggs so that in some way you can find additional stem cells to manipulate. There needs to be appropriate filters. But once those filters are put into place, halakha embraces society's hard sell, recognizes our responsibility to be involved in this issue. And it's important for us to realize it's the Masorah of two psukim in Parshat Mishpatim that remind us of our halakhic responsibility to be involved in this terrific scientific initiative that, please God, will allow us to help so many people in challenging situations by creating the next generation of medicine. Thank you very much. Okay, we have, we'll take one or two questions and then we'll end. Yes. So let me just answer both questions. First of all, the first question, if someone was in a situation within the first 40 days and needed to deal with certain issues of abortion, they should speak to their local postdoc to answer that question. But there is more of a license to deal with issues of abortion within the first 40 days than there is after the 40 days. And any postdoc that would deal with this issue would recognize that factor. Secondly, I'm not a doctor, and I can't totally speak to the second issue, but in every discussion that I've had with those involved in reproductive therapy, with radiologists and others, they tell me that the 40 days, that there is a significant difference of what you can see within fetal development, and they don't view, the question that I get from them is, how did Chazal so many years ago know what I see when I do some type of, you know, fetal monitors and see that development? How did Chazal recognize in the 40, 45 days or so that there is a quickening process that happens? How did Chazal know that? Obviously, they were involved in some form of autopsies or things of that nature for them to be able to know. That's the question I get from them. So in almost every situation that I have spoken to, and I have actually chavrutot in these fields, they have all told me that that there is a development that is seen. And if you look at the books by Netter that shows pictures of fetal development, you will see that what Chazal recognized is seen within the pictures that are found within Netter's books. Netter, N-E-T-T-E-R. Yes. The question is about rejection of genetic material. So one of the great things about one of the diagrams that I showed you is, for example, figure number 3 is you using your own genetic material. So the chances of rejection, at least based on the research that I've been exposed to, is, you know, slim to none, because it's your own genetic material. In fact, we recently had around 17 months ago, we had a child born, and I had the blood of the cord frozen, because the blood of the cord also has stem cells, and I figured that my son should never need it, but please God, as the stem cell development continues, research continues, there will be stem cells that that are almost totally his genetic makeup within the cord that are now frozen. If he or any member of the family should ever need them, that they are available. And by the way, it's something that can be done by everybody. Yes. I don't know the answer to the last question. The question was, what's the feeling amongst the YU Rosh Yeshivas on this issue? And what question is, what is the feelings regarding the general group of post-game around the world on this issue, and the dialogue with the president on this issue? The last thing I have no clue about. The first two is, I think in my discussions with many of the Rosh Yeshivas that this is their opinion. The RCA and the OU basically signed letters celebrating this opinion. In Eretz Israel, under the leadership of many of the poskim, all of this stem cell research is being done. Israel was way ahead of America in issues of stem cell research because of this challenge. And there you find that the poskim, both within the religious Zionist community, as well as within the more Haredi community, embraces it because they recognize, with the appropriate filters, because they recognize the capacity for us to heal so many diseases through the ability to deal with these issues. In general, in issues of fertility, you find that the religious Zionists and the Haredi community work well together, because no one wants to have a child that's only kosher according to the OU, and not to the Chafke, and not to the Skarke, not to the Badats. No one wants something like that. We all want to create a kehilah that celebrates the capacity of some form of unity. We'll stop here. Thank you very much.